Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I'm Janet Ellis, and this is Twice Upon a Time, where each week I invite a guest to come and chat with me about their favourite childhood book. They often bring along their own battered copy. This is a podcast to celebrate that magical book which cast a spell over us and often still has us in its thrall. Welcome to Twice Upon a Time, Hayley Mills, actress and author. Although when I say actress, Hayley, that really doesn't sum up how I feel about what you've done on screen and stage, but we'll get back to that. First of all, can you tell me what book you've chosen for us?
I have chosen My Friend Flicker by Mary O'Hara.
And how old were you when you first read it, do you think?
I've been trying to remember. I think either 10 or 12, so I'm going to split the difference and say 11. It made a big impression.
And have you reread it since?
Yes.
And what do you discover about it each time? Because I have to say, I have got, and although this is only a podcast, I'm going to show you my, this is one of my copies, and I've got, this is part one, I've got part two as well. And I obviously had read it as a child, about exactly the same age as you. But I had not realised until I read it now how sophisticated it is, how dark and extraordinary the writing is.
Yes.
When you first read it, what were your feelings about it? Can you remember?
I remember being absolutely obsessed by it because it is so extremely well written, and it's not written down for to children at all. She writes for herself as an adult about children and about horses and about the life on the ranch and Wyoming. And it is so descriptive and beautiful. And as you say, you know, there are some horrendous things in it. It is dark. She doesn't sort of protect you from, you know, the death of the horse or the terrors of storms it's grown-up writing, and I hadn't realised at the time that it was. Maybe the books we read were all reading rather more grown-up books. I honestly don't know, but I do remember when I finished the book, sobbing and writing in the back. I don't have my particular copy, unfortunately, but writing in the back, you know, passionately about the book. Because I completely connected to all the characters, to Ken and his brother and the parents and the mother and to horses. I read it because I was mad about horses, but it so illuminated horses for me. I became even more madly in love with them. So I think it really was the first grown-up book that I read, but I thought I was reading a book for children.
Yeah, I absolutely, absolutely empathise with that. And when you read, where did you go to read? Or could you just take a book with you anywhere? Did you have a special reading place?
I used to read in my bedroom at the farm in Sussex. I used to read on the top of the Dutch barn when it was full of hay. I used to go up into the chestnut tree opposite the house. There was a wonderful branch there with a perfect curve, so I could sit with my back on it, my feet up in front of me, and read and hide, and no one knew I was there. I had lots of hiding places. And of course, in those days, I didn't feel guilty about reading in the middle of the day.
You don't feel guilty about that now, I hope.
There is a little twinge of guilt, but I'm older now, so that's my excuse.
Absolutely, yeah, I sanction that anyway. And were your brother and sister readers too?
Yes, I think so. I mean, my brother was 3 years younger than me, so at that time, when he was growing up, he was a great sportsman, and he was also very keen on being a farmer. He was up and out early, and you know, hedging and ditching and hanging out with the herdsmen and getting their cows in and all that. And Juliet, I think she was. I don't honestly know. Although there were three of us and we all, you know, loved each other and everything, we all had our separate lives because we lived on a farm. And Juliet, being 5 years older than me, by the time I was reading my friend Flicker, she was 16 and going on 17 and going out with boys. And also she started work in the theatre. You know, she started doing a play when she was 17.
Let's go into this story because it really is the most extraordinary one. And it made me feel as though, like you, I read the book because I was passionate about horses, although I have to say a little bit scared of them too. But I love the idea of being a rider, if not the practicality. But I don't remember this book in as much detail as coming back to it impressed on me, because I do think the story is extraordinary. And obviously our conversation is fully about the story, so I can reveal for a start that Flicker herself doesn't even appear until nearly a third of the way through the book.
That's right.
You know, yes. And the rest of it is so detailed. I think one of the brilliant things that, many brilliant things that she does is to invoke a sense of place. Yes. And this is all in the sort of badlands of Wyoming, with names like Laramie and, you know, places that I wasn't even sure how to pronounce, let alone imagine. Had you ever been anywhere like that in your life at that point?
No, never, no. No, it was a very seductive, very, very romantic place. I imagined it, you know, lush and green with the far purple hills, and wild horses, wild herds, and the fascination of this white albino, these horses with this wicked strain.
The loco strain.
Them, that they were, in, you know, you couldn't break them in. They were wild and independent, but fast and magical. You know, one imagine catching one and jumping on its back and riding like the wind into the purple hills. It really captured my imagination immensely.
Tell me the story, because actually it doesn't take long, does it? What actually happens in the book? How would you sum it up?
Well, Ken, the boy, is absolutely obsessed with horses. They have a ranch, you know, it's a stud farm, and he's old enough now to have his own horse. He's a bit of a problem. He screws up regularly, and his parents, you know, despair of him. His older brother is much more sensible, and he's a bit of a dreamer. So all kids can identify with him. But his father realizes, and his mother, they're both sensitive, wise parents in lots of ways. And his father realizes that for him to have his own horse and to have that responsibility, he needs that to grow up.
He's very resistant to it at first, though, isn't he? His older brother, Howard, has had a horse. Obviously, he's a couple of years older, so he's had this colt for a while. But his father, Rob, says that Ken is too much of a dreamer, and anyway, he's just done really badly at school, so he might have to repeat a year, which they pay for. So it's his mother, really, isn't it, arguing the case for him to be allowed the privilege of this colt. Actually, I have to tell you something that I initially, when I reread it, I read what I now realise was an unabridged version.
Oh, yes.
And one thing that comes through very strongly, even in what we've read, is the adult voices, which is so unusual in a children's book. The adults are given absolute prominence in this story, aren't they? Including how they feel about each other, how they feel about finances. There's a continual worry.
Yes.
And you get the sense of, as we've talked about, this massive landscape. And right in the middle of the story is a tiny group of people. Mm. And they don't see many other people. So the sense of enclosure within this extraordinary, untamable landscape, as untamable as the horses that roam it, and then them just really seeing each other all the time. You know, this is the start of the summer holidays, and there's a brilliant description, I think, right at the beginning of the book, where Ken is sitting on a horse, cigarette, and he's up early to ride, and he's looking down from a very high viewpoint across the land that contains the farm. And it's the acreage of the farm is huge anyway. So wherever he looks, it's kind of their land. And he knows that other people, other adults, are responsible for it. But the whole sense of this sort of bird's eye view from the back of a horse particularly, and looking down on his life, is such an instant image, isn't it? It gets you right into the book straight away.
Yes, absolutely.
And it continues like that, really. Mm-hmm. It continues in this extraordinary, really gutsy descriptions of how it feels to actually run a place like that and to be very close to penury, if not bankruptcy, very, very close indeed. But I think, weirdly, because he is so passionate about this horse and the one he chooses, the one he calls Flicker, is actually not the foal that they thought they were going to give him, is it? Because the one they thought they would give him is actually killed by a mountain lion. And that's another thing, that wrong word here, but dogs the action.
Right, that's right.
But he sees this sorrel filly running away and thinks, that's my horse. Is that how you felt about riding? Did you have a kind of real connection with it?
I did. And I loved the way, the reason that he bunted that little filly is that as she was galloping past him, terrified, he looked at her and she looked at him and they made a connection. And that gave me goose pimples. And it does to this day when I think about it. To have that connection with an animal, with a horse. The horse means freedom and independence, grace and beauty and wildness. And, you know, I think it's deep in our psyche, our love of horses.
Did you have a pony when you were little? I did.
I was very, very, very lucky. My first pony was called Nancy, and she was red-haired, and she was really stubborn and used to bite me. But that was good. I learned to ride on her. And then when we were living at the farm when I was about 9, when I got my pony, Annabelle, and she was a skewbald. We used to just go off and spend all day riding and into the woods and singing away. Well, I did the singing. She did the listening. You know, I was so happy just being with her. I didn't need anybody else.
Is skewbald brown and white and piebald black and white? Is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
And how many hands was she? Do you remember?
13.
Just a pony.
Yes.
One more hand and she's in horse territory. I was really struck reading this with how affectionate Mary O'Hara is about all of the characters, even when they behave, not badly exactly, that's too strong, but they have difficulties with each other. Mm. And in particular, when you first meet Ken and she is observing him, as I say, on this quite recalcitrant horse, it bucks him off actually very soon into the narrative because he digs his heels in and he knows his father will be cross about that too. He's living in fear of his father right the way through the book.
Yes.
But she describes him as beautiful and she says he had the whiteness of winter school days. And I thought, gosh, that's just the most perfect description of exactly how he looked just at that moment.
Yes.
Beautiful. But then we get to, woven through the story, the character of his mother, Nell. How did she strike you?
I thought Nell was absolutely, you know, an angel. I'd got beyond the time in those days of wanting to have pictures in the books because they never were the right, they didn't look right. I didn't like pictures. And my picture of Nell was beautiful. Her description of Nell was beautiful. She had her hair tied back, very smooth in a bun at the nape of her neck. And she was gentle and wise and clever with people and intuitive. I guess a kind of a role model, really. Would love to think one would grow up to be a bit of a Nell rather than a Nelly. and of course, I fell in love with Ken. Sweet little boy. And then the other three books, Thunderhead and Green Grass of Wyoming, and he gets older and he eventually has a relationship with a girl. And I was like, oh, I don't know about that. But I remember one sentence in Green Grass of Wyoming where he's lying on the grass and he's wearing a tartan shirt. He's looking at her and she sees his heartbeat under the pocket of his tartan shirt. It's like, that was so beautiful.
That's Casey, isn't it? He falls in love with
Casey. That's right.
Yeah.
And it was romantic in a way that children, when you fall in love, you can fall in love, you know, at 12. I certainly fell in love at 12. And it's just perfect.
I completely get that. It's that, because actually, this book is a love story, isn't it?
It's
just that the love object is Flicker, you know, this beautiful, rather wild, untamable.
Mm.
And all the feelings that you have, especially when you first fall in love, at whatever age, I think, you almost don't need the love object. It's all about how you feel. It's all about your reflections and you know, how special you feel because you've discovered this lovely person or pony.
Yes.
I think it's perfectly possible to feel that at 12. It's just that because your emotions are febrile at that stage and untamable, you don't quite know where to put it all. And
yes.
And you also, I suppose, feel that you don't have the same, it's not quite license to be in love, but you don't have the territory that goes with it that you think adults inhabit.
Exactly. Yes. You don't. It's all in your mind. It's all a romantic ideal that there's this amazing creature, a human being or a horse in the world, you know. And I think from that moment on, I never wanted to not be in love. I wanted to be in love all the time.
It's a nice place to be. It's a nice place to be. I completely agree. And just before we leave Nell, because I was so struck by this, that when Mary O'Hara is describing them, she says she's a former Bryn Mawr athlete. So you immediately know she takes up her space, you know, she's made for these difficult places she's living, but she's still maidenly. That's the word she uses specifically. And she says her skin has a luster that came from persistent care, which is just a little thumbnail description, which any writer would use if they could, because it just says so much, not just, you know, she had nice skin, but persistent care meant that this woman, Nell, faced herself. You know, she hadn't shied away from mirrors. She was living in pretty much an all-male environment, certainly two sons and husband, two hands who lived in an outbuilding. But most of the people she sees are men.
Yes.
And yet she obviously faces herself at some point during the day. And because Mary O'Hara herself lived on a ranch, as you probably know, and did farm horses and had a Swedish husband, and one of the ranch hands, Gus, is Swedish. And in fact, he names the colt because Flicker is Swedish for little girl.
Right.
But I thought that's so subtle, isn't it?
Yes.
And Gus calls her Mrs. You know, what do you want me to do today, Mrs.? And she hates it because she feels it's reductive of who she is.
Yes.
Actually, you know, it's quite feminist, actually.
Yes.
I'm not sure that's what Mary intended, but I treasure it. I treasure it.
Yes, 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 you're absolutely right. When was it published? In the 50s, early 50s?
Earlier, 40s, 40, 43,
was
I think.
It?
First published, yeah.
So rereading it, you know, recently, and a lot of it was as current and as relevant because the writing is so good. I found some of the dialogue a little bit of the 40s or early 50s, which actually gives it a kind of charm, but that's the only area in which it has suffered from the passage of time, because the story and the relationship with the boy and the understanding and obviously the great love that she had about horses and the wonderful place that they live is still very, very alive and fascinating.
I know what you mean about the dialogue. It's funny, isn't it? Because some of it, although she actually had a career as a screenwriter at one point too, so she must have been used to handling dialogue, although initially she wrote, in inverted commas, for silent movies, so obviously was just using her descriptive powers then.
Right.
But in amongst, there are these little tiny modern spots, aren't there? For example, when... And again, we're allowed kind of into the bedroom where the mother and father are having conversations about their son and whether he's a daydreamer, which will actually be to his detriment in life, and you know, he doesn't deserve the cult, but also about money and about what they should be doing next generally. Mm. And when they have any kind of altercation, Rob, the husband, turns to his wife and says, "Do you love me?" And she finds that incredibly annoying. But at that very moment when they're sort of at loggerheads, right. He says this thing, which is really quite insightful, I think.
It's a wonderful narrative and a wonderful story. And I hope that kids are still reading it today. I hope they are.
You know, that's one thing I haven't checked, that it's still in print. I hope it is. How did you get hold of your copy? Was it a gift from someone or did you buy it yourself?
Well, now, Janet, it's a few years ago. I suspect it was a present. I've no idea who from. Maybe my mother, who was a writer and a good writer. So it was quite possibly from her. I'm sure I didn't buy it, but I did buy the next two. I definitely did.
In the original one I read, the unabridged version, there's quite a lot more description of animal husbandry. There's a great long section, for example, on gelding.
Oh, really?
Don't read before breakfast because it's really quite... And that's saying something, isn't it? Because there's a lot of violence in this book.
I mean, the storm and the death of Flicker's mother.
Rocket, yeah. Yeah.
Mare is... terrifying. They finally catch her. She's jumped fences and it's been a terrible, they've got her finally into a corral because she was stolen by the crazy white glorious albino and went off and had the most wonderful time with his herd. And it's such a marvelous idea, of course, and it's true that this white stallion only chose the best mares from the domesticated stud farm. So he stole this beautiful black mare. She's very, very difficult. I think that they're going to sell her. They're going to give her to someone who has a stud farm and reckons he can handle her. And they finally get her into a horse wagon, which is open. The sides are high and it's open. And they're driving out of the stud farm under the gate. And she lunges in a desperate attempt to jump over the sides of the truck, smashes her head into the iron over the bar overhead as they're going under, and kills herself.
It's such a shock.
And he was like, I can't believe I'm reading this. This is absolutely... And then there's this horrific description of what they have to do when a horse dies.
Exactly.
And they drag it by its feet, you know, with a tractor, and then hurl it into a pit. You know, it's like I'd forgotten. I thought this was a lovely children's book about horses.
It made you feel the weight of the horse, didn't it?
Yes.
The weight of an inert horse that is suddenly not moving as it should and has to be dealt with. And Flicker herself sustains horrible injuries too.
Yes, of course, nearly dies. Yes. My understanding of writing is very limited, but I do understand, you know, if you're writing a book, you've got to have conflict to keep people interested enough to keep turning the page. And right from the beginning, there's conflict. And things that need to be resolved.
And also an enormous sense of jeopardy all the way through. Obviously, there's the mountain lion, which is attacking their cattle and potentially their horses, probably killed Rocket's original colt. There's the violence of the landscape, really. You know, everything needs to be battled.
The storms.
Yes. And then, obviously, Flicker's awful injuries. and the way that Ken, the little boy, has to cope with nearly losing her, and in fact, nearly dies himself. I really must insist, though, for anyone who hasn't read this book, do not let these descriptions of what happens put you off, because there's so much more in it, isn't there, than
yes.
just these bare descriptions of the actual action.
It's a saga. You know, people behave heroically with tremendous bravery and great love.
It's interesting talking about love, isn't it? Because right at the end, when Ken is seriously ill, I mean, he keeps Flicker alive by holding her head up when she's fallen into a pond and therefore gets pneumonia and is incredibly ill, you know, raging temperatures. But the doctor who appears, who is, again, one of these extraordinary, instantly rounded characters, the Dr. Rodney Scott, who comes in and identifies Ken's trajectory through life. He says, you know, he's seen falling in love, bliss, despair, sacrifice, and death. And he says that to Ken's mother, and they both recognize that this has been a love story all along.
Yes.
Who were you in love with when you were 12, Hayley? Can you say?
I certainly can. I've written a book about it. It was an actor. He was 26, and a German actor called Horst Buchost. And I did a movie with him. So I was living another life.
You were living another life. In fact, you're the first person I've ever spoken to who somebody tried to beguile you with the gift of an otter in a bath.
That's right.
I'm aware that for my generation, there are two really amazing things about you. The first is that when I say your name to people,
yes.
it's like they've come out of a dark place into light.
Oh, what a beautiful thing to say.
But the other thing that really struck me is that, you know, having, Pollyanna was the first film I ever saw. So, you know, it's that stuck. And then I've obviously watched everything ever since. But you were living out the fantasies of our childhood. That's what we went and watched on screen. So how does that square with trying to find your own fantasy life in the pages of a book?
Oh, well, that's exactly what one does. I was really lucky to start acting as young as I did, because when I did my first movie, Tiger Bay, I was still at that time when my imaginary life was very powerful. And so when I started acting, it was just kind of, you know, an extension of what I was doing in my head anyway, which is what children do, and I hope they still do.
But was there a time when you sort of thought, I can act? Does that ever happen?
Well, I always knew I was acting. I always knew, you know, I was doing what my dad did. I think what happened was, you know, when I got into adolescence and self-conscious, it wasn't quite as simple. Self-consciousness is absolutely the kiss of death for an actor, that, you know, almost anything else. You know, you could be covered in acne, but do not be self-conscious about it. That was a horrible period of my life, and I wanted to give it up, get away and hide, because I was becoming a woman, and, you know, we don't know what that means. We're afraid. It's such a responsibility. What kind of a woman? I'm not going to be any good at it. Everybody liked me as a child, but who is this woman, you know, with boobs and bum? And and so I realized that I'd lost that instinctive, unquestioning ability to just be. Maybe a lot of actors feel like this, that, you know, you spend a lot of time when you're working on a new part, you want to get rid of the lines, so you're not thinking about the lines. So the lines just feel organic, and then you can get back to that instinctive, spontaneous thing. And the older I get, the closer one gets, I think, because there are less hang-ups about, you know, worrying about yourself and where you fail as a person.
As you're saying that, I'm sort of thinking that one of the extraordinary things about your childhood, of course, is that you knew what people thought of you. You know, as a child, mostly you can only speculate on that. And you're usually part of a big group, a class or a group of friends who pass the baton, don't they, between each other as to who's the most important. But you had adult eyes on you as a child in a way that most of us don't. Do most of us escape that? Or is that something that doesn't really have any bearing on exactly what you've described, the difficult journey into adolescence and beyond?
It's a kind of double-edged sword, really. In one respect, it's very reassuring, it's encouraging. And in another respect, it makes you too aware too soon. Also, it makes you realize you have a responsibility. I think we're all much more aware of our failings than our, you know, advantages and our, you know, our talents. So I think it's difficult if you're made too aware of yourself too soon. I didn't read notices. And although I think it made it more difficult in one respect because it isolated me from the business, when I'd finished making a movie, I went back to school, a normal school. If I'd made a movie in Hollywood, I came back. I never stayed there. I came back and went to my boarding school in Camberley, in Surrey. So I had this sort of split lives. You know, I had my working life and movies and all of that. And then totally, absolutely, utterly normal boarding school. And home was a farm in the middle of Sussex. So I didn't live the life of a little movie star in Hollywood. And I came, and every time I went to Hollywood, it was all like, wow, here I am again. This is amazing. It's like Disneyland. But, you know, I was lucky because my father was an actor. So being on the set and the life, everyday life, was familiar. It was a job, and it was, you know, very long hours. And I took it seriously right from the beginning because he did, and everybody did. You know, it wasn't being starry-eyed. I wasn't starry-eyed about it at all. And I loved it. I loved what I did.
It's coming across. It's really coming across. And I have to say, I'm deeply impressed at your analysis of how you coped with that, because you would have been allowed to really rebel against one side of it or the other. You are remarkably grounded. Your sense of self is enviable. It is impossible to separate out how I feel about you as a person, as a woman, and how I feel about you on screen, which was entrancing. I mean, the films that you gave us are absolutely entrancing. And they have stood the test of time.
You know, it's really lucky. The first things you do are good.
Yeah.
The first book you read is great. It sets the level forever. I was so lucky to make half a dozen really good movies because they were well written, they had great directors, they were incredibly well cast. So that raised my awareness, my game.
Yeah, like, that's so true.
I was in films working with actors that were wonderful, truthful actors.
I think that's so true what you say about if the first things that you do or read are good, that sets the bar. And right back to this book, if the first thing or person that you love is careful with your heart, that makes you believe in love.
Exactly. So when terrible things happen to children, they carry that throughout their lives, unless they're terribly fortunate and lucky and have people who can help them deal with it.
What was the film you made with Roddy McDowall? Remind me.
The film I made with Roddy McDowall was a Disney movie called That Darn Cat.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
It was, he played the irritating neighbor. That Darn Cat was a Siamese cat who becomes involved in a potential murder. Instead of one cat, we had to have like five because each cat did a different trick. You know, opening the cat flap, opening a door or climbing over a fence or whatever it was. And I have to say, I loved Roddy very much and I knew him very well. And I did look at the movie of my friend Flicker recently Well, it's a long time ago, and I think probably Roddy was about 12, 13.
I don't remember seeing that film. I'm wondering whether it got saccharined out to make it just about horses and steers and roping and
it was,
you know, less about the gelding, let's say.
They didn't get the book on the screen, let's just say that. It's a very, very difficult thing to do.
Can't thank you enough. It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been really a great pleasure. I've been so interested talking to you, and your understanding of the book has actually illuminated it for me.
I was truly blown away by rereading it. I got hold of this copy, which I think is like the one you read, which smells deliciously of old bookshops.
Yes, so is mine.
And I thought, oh, and then I opened it and, well, Mary, too late to tell her in person, but I couldn't put it down. It's extraordinary.
Yes.
It is extraordinary.
Yes, it really is. Well, bless you. Lovely. And I look forward to meeting you.
See you in the West. Thank you so much for listening. This has been Twice Upon a Time with me, Janet Ellis. The producer is Caroline Raphael. Recording and post-production by John Wakefield and Diggory Waite. All the titles mentioned are on the podcast show page. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Twice Upon a Pod for pictures of our guests and their brilliant books. And if you like the show, do recommend to a friend or leave us a review. The executive producer is Claire Broughton, and Twice Upon a Time is a Hat Trick podcast.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.